And it's suffering a lot, it's crying, it's suffering, it's got fever. Now the mother, if she could take that suffering on herself, you know, if she could take it instead, she would do it. It's true, isn't it? You agree? Yeah. So she would do it. But not just she would do it, she would be so happy to do it. You know, she would be so happy if she could take that suffering. She'd be so happy to take it. For her, that would be a joy. In fact, she wouldn't experience suffering, she just experienced joy because she's able to take on that sickness. So then she said, you see, this is just because the way of viewing. So he said, this is how Bodhisattva, from Bodhisattva. Because Bodhisattva sees all sentient beings like that, sees all the suffering, and just feels like if they can take the suffering, they'll just become more joyful. You shouldn't think Bodhisattvas suffer. They don't suffer the way we think of in terms of suffering. You shouldn't think compassion means you sit in the corner and cry. And she said, they won't understand the meaning of compassion. Compassion doesn't bring your mind down. It never brings your mind down. It just gives you more and more energy and more and more joy to help others. Because you see, you can do something. Remember that guy I was talking about, you know, when I was giving a talk in Queen Street, and that guy said to me, when you look at all the darkness in the world, how do you stop yourself from feeling despair? And I just gave the answer His Holiness gives. You know, because you never give up. You never give up the thought that you can make a difference. You just never give up that thought, that belief that you can make a difference. So when you really feel like that, like you never give up the fact that in your life you can make a difference. You can, every one of us can. We are all one of the 1,000 arms of generosity. We all have a job to do. It's just like those 19,000 people. You know, this Dharma walks on the stage and 19,000 people connect with that love and they feel that love inside of them, and those 19,000 people go off and they spread that love to others. Then isn't that amazing? It's like it's not about the Dalai Lama, it's just about connecting. It's just about connecting. And that really is what we're talking about with healing, you see. We are, ultimately we are whole, we are healed, we don't have sickness, we don't have these things. We have to connect with that. And then let go of these other things. So impermanence is something very important to think about. Impermanence. That we're impermanent, that others are impermanent, that everything we hold on to, grasp onto is impermanent and will cease. And that wouldn't produce in us a sense of fear. Instead it would produce in us a sense of just kindness to others. Kindness. That's the first of the wrong ways of seeing things. I just mentioned that was pretty. So another way they see, and another way is another way they say, like, you know, because we see what we see as beautiful, that which is actually not. And then we get caught up in the beauty, the attractiveness, other people's bodies, are clinging to all this. But actually, as I said yesterday, it's just like the dead skin cells. We get so attracted to something which, if you look under the skin, is not attractive at all. We cling to our own bodies. We spend so much money trying to make them nice and beautiful. It was in Florida. Of course, California is a body beautiful place, but. Florida seems to be really something else. They were telling me about these operations as a whole. Because when you go to the beach in Florida, I think you go to be seen. Probably you go to pick people up, actually. Something like that. I think you go to be seen and admired, like a bird. Like, you know, birds dance. Isn't that where the birds are? So then you have to make sure the body's beautiful. But of course you can't keep the body beautiful all the time. Right? You have the same experience. So So can we get old and it gets flabby? And so can you imagine the suffering when you've clung to your beauty or the beauty of your body and you just see it disintegrating? Then you have to have all these expensive operations and put all these face creams and all this and that and get the right clothes and the designer clothes, and it's just endless, isn't it? Can you imagine the suffering of identifying as being your body? It must be terrible. Because no one in this room is doing that. So we have to put our minds into that way of thinking. No, seriously, I mean, you wouldn't be here. You just wouldn't be here. I mean, clearly you understand that the mind is really, really important, the beauty of the mind. You wouldn't be here. But there are people who just totally identify the beauty of their bodies, and then just they've got to keep up this whole facade all the time. Then they have all these operations to move this up and move that down and cut this out. And costs a lot of money. Michael Jackson, isn't it? And his nose moved up and this and bleached the skin and did that. And he looked so weird afterwards. He actually kind of looked, it was kind of cute when he was this young frizzy haired kid. And suddenly he started, it became quite strange, isn't it? How, so unnatural. And they were talking about this one operation. And what they do, they said there's a queue. A few people waiting to have this, cost thousands of dollars, and you have a rubber band put in your stomach, wrapped around your stomach, and it's to stop you eating too much, so you can keep thin. So, because you put this kind of rubber band, I mean, I'm sure it's not just a rubber band, so it's some kind of thing that you put around the stomach, so then you can't eat so much. And then, but I think the reason they do it is to try and be beautiful. I don't think it's I think it's a cosmetic thing. I think so. You heard about this one? Yeah. I think it's cosmetic. I don't. Oh, I don't know, really. Well, I hope we don't need any operation. Oh, that'd be wet. That'd be like, can you imagine? Buddhist man goes along. How many thousand dollars? And then they say, by the way, you might think about changing your clothes and growing some hair. So, anyway, just the suffering. I just think the suffering, if you identify with your body, it must be terrible. And there must always be other people who are more beautiful than you. Isn't it? So you have this pride, you have jealousy, but you're fighting losing battle because of course you'll get old and sick and it will all wither away and you won't be able to do anything about it. You're really... Anyway, so seeing what's beautiful, seeing what actually is the nature of being ugly. His Holiness Dalai Lama always gives this example. He said, even if you have the most beautiful food, I think of Belgian chocolates, handmade Belgian chocolates, that's got to be good, hasn't it? So handmade Belgian chocolates, which you can't get in this country, I think, fortunately, so I can mention them without the fear that somebody will say, oh, you talked about how we built in chocolates. handmade Belgian chocolates, there's always somebody who doesn't like chocolate. Anyway, so you have this delicious handmade Belgian chocolates with nuts and all these kind of things in it. And then somebody puts it in their mouth and then take it out again. It's like, they're not the same, isn't it? Like, you put it in your mouth, and then someone else says, oh, the last one's gone. And you say, pull it out. Would you like this one? So his Holiness says, well, you know, that's a very clear example that the body's unclean. So if that handmade Belgian chocolate, he doesn't use his own handmade Belgian chocolates, because I'm sure he doesn't. I mean, I don't know if it's zombie food. But anyway, if you put that handmade Belgian chocolate into a machine like a coffee grinder or a mince grinder and somebody said, oh, the last one's gone, you say, oh, we'll have this one. They say, oh, thank you, I'll have it. Because the machine's not considered dirty, but, you know, we do consider the body as dirty, don't we? It goes in. And even if it went all the way in and it came out the other side, you wouldn't want it. Yeah, really. So that's just an indication that the body is not as beautiful. My teacher says, you know, you just imagine peeling away the skin and just all the impurities underneath. There's nothing attractive, really, about the body. So, but we get caught up, don't we? And then many people just get totally caught up in their lives, for many years of their lives, they just get totally caught up in this kind of craving, looking for happiness. So then what? So then Buddha's actually says, the thing that we label happiness is actually the nature of suffering. Now this one I think I had to talk about this afternoon, because it gets quite, you know, this one you've got to kind of... I want to talk about this whole idea that Buddhism's dealing with, that every single being is the same and that they want happiness, they don't want suffering. Now this is what the Dalai Lama, when he starts giving a talk, he nearly always begins by saying this: we are all the same. It doesn't matter what we look like, it doesn't matter what colour our skin, it doesn't matter what language we speak, it doesn't matter what religion we have. We all want happiness. We're all trying to avoid suffering. We all have an equal right to find happiness. We all have an equal right to be free of suffering. And we all can find perfect happiness and be free of suffering. The question is, you know, where we're looking. Where are we looking? So then we have to actually grasp what Buddhism is talking about when it talks about happiness. Buddhism actually asks us to examine and analyze and go a bit deeper and check. You know, happiness. What is real happiness? This is a question that's going to ask. And what is suffering? Anyway, for the moment, I'll just throw this one out. The Buddha says that even those things that we think of as being happiness are only in the nature of suffering. Now, I didn't say there was suffering. I said they were in the nature of suffering. In other words, the happiness that they bring doesn't last, isn't permanent, doesn't satisfy us. It just sets up a craving for more. Buddhism is going to say that there is a happiness which lasts, which totally satisfies us, and which the more we get of it, the more happy we become, the more satisfied, the more content. It's unlimited, it's available to all of us, and most of us never experience that because we simply don't know where to look. This is Dharma happiness. My teacher calls it Dharma happiness. And I even don't really like using the word happiness to describe it. I think it's more joy, I think. I think joy is a better word. Because happiness is a little bit kind of ha ha ha, isn't it? Whereas joy is more, has a sense of like total fulfillment, and like there is enough there and there's far more as well. So this is what the Buddha is pointing towards, what the Dalai Lama is pointing towards, and they are going to explain how to get there. Don't worry. Some people think Buddhism is very pessimistic because it starts off by saying life is suffering. But that's just the first of the Four Noble Truths. The first thing the Buddha said was life is suffering. But the next three are explaining how to get rid of all that suffering completely, how to eliminate it. So that's just all good news. First one is life is suffering. But then also you must explain what the Buddha means when he says suffering. So we can't just leave it at that. That's too simple. You know, I have to do a lot more talking, and I don't want to do it this morning because we had enough. So I'm going to just look at this whole existential idea and view and how Buddha saw things. Now remember, Buddha saw things, when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, the very first teaching the Buddha gave, they're called noble, another word for noble is Arya, and the sense is, this is what is true, or this is how somebody who has a direct perception of reality, someone who is connected, somebody who, actually you can say they're superior beings because they're just not caught in the wrong view, in the mesh and the prisons of wrong views that we are. They're someone who is free, who's completely connected with reality, whose minds have become limitless and expansive, and so this is how they see things. So then of course, you know, we have to do a little bit of work to see how somebody who has that kind of mind sees things, because it's not the way we normally see things. And it's interesting to think that way. It gives us a different perspective. So they see that how we live our lives is suffering. And they see that there's a reason why it's suffering. There's a reason why we have all those problems and difficulties and the endless things. That there's a cause. In fact, two causes. It causes delusions and karma. You know, the delusions in our minds and the actions that they motivate us to do, which bring suffering results. And they see that every single one of these causes can be eliminated, that we don't have to have it. And then they explain the path. the way to do it. So this is the Four Noble Truths, the very first teaching the Buddha gave, which is really the fundamental, all the other teachings come from that. And the fourth way in which we see things, we see things incorrectly. So we're caught in this thing where we're thinking things permanent, where they're impermanent. You know, we're going to live forever and we're not, we're going to die. We're caught in this, we're caught in this sense that, you know, caught up in objects as being attractive and happiness that are actually only the nature of suffering, and they can never totally fulfill us. They never can, because they in and of themselves are impermanent and not lasting and not satisfying. And then we're caught in this view also that things exist in and of themselves, when in reality the Buddha explained that whatever exists, exists independent upon others. Therefore, there is nothing that exists in and of itself. Or how they put it in Buddhism is, there is nothing that exists inherently. And this is what we call the wisdom realizing emptiness, the empty nature of all phenomena, including ourselves, including our own minds, including emptiness itself. And what does that mean? It means that, for example, when you look at me, when you look at this nun called Sarah, you see what appears to you is a nun, and you know, well, actually, basically, what appears to you at the very beginning is just a base. It's just a base. It's just, you know, red, woman wearing red. That's all it is. But you know, you've been told the labels. The label is nun, and the label is Sarah. You've been told that, and Buddhist. So you know that. So what is appearing this on this base, you know, you see the base, and on that base you put the label, nun, Sarah. And the very next minute, what appears back to you is a nun called Sarah, who exists in and of herself, you know, from her own side. You see something inherently here, without depending on your mind, your labels, your way of viewing, your perception. And you have a sense that that truly exists. Now, there is a nun called Sarah sitting here giving a talk, but there is no inherently existing, self-existent nun called Sarah sitting here giving a talk. That one doesn't exist at all. So, in Buddhism, what is negated is this sense. Just as we have to negate the sense of any permanence of a nun called Sarah, we have to negate any sense of the inherent existence of a nun called Sarah. Doesn't exist that way at all, not the slightest atom. Doesn't exist. It's not how it appears to us, but how things appear to us and how they actually exist is the opposite. And this is why we get caught. We get caught up believing things really exist the way we see them to. And that's why we get angry and we get attached. You know, why we get jealous, why we get proud, because we just haven't seen reality. We haven't seen reality. The things don't exist that way. So maybe I'll talk a little bit more about this later. Again, that's not a whole subject. But this is dealing with wisdom. Now the path, what is the path in Buddhism? The path in Buddhism, you remember I said Om Mani Padme Hum contains everything. Om is invoking the enlightened... Om, actually almost consists of three syllables, A-U-Ma. A-U-Ma symbolizes the enlightened body, speech and mind. So the body, speech and mind of Buddha, Om. Mani means jewel, and it has a sense of all the method aspects of the path, and in this particular case we're going to say compassion. Pema, or Padma, is lotus, and it has the connotation, signifies all the wisdom aspects of the path, which in this case we're going to say emptiness, you know, that things don't have any intrinsic existence. So Mani Pema together is wisdom and compassion. And that is the path, like the two wings of the bird that take you to enlightenment, wisdom and compassion. Wisdom which eliminates the wrong view of there being an I, a me, a mine, a self. And it's on the basis of believing there's an I, me, mine and a self that every other delusion arises, attachment arises, anger arises. Anger arises because, why? Because somebody does something you don't want them to do, or they don't do something you do want them to do. There's only two reasons why you get angry. Do you get that? Either somebody does something you don't want them to do, or they don't do what you do want them to do. That's the only reason you get angry. There's two reasons. You can extend it and you can say, because they didn't do what my friend wanted them to do, or they did what my friend didn't want them to do, but basically that's it. Or they did what my enemy wanted them to do, and they didn't do... Oh, I can't remember now. But basically it's just that. So it's me. Attachment is what? You know, attachment is I want this, you know, clinging to this for me. I mean mine. Jealousy is what? Jealousy is thinking what, you know, I ought to have what that person has. Pride is what? Thinking that I'm superior or I'm inferior. In Buddhism there are different kinds of pride. There's a pride which says I'm the best, and there's a pride which says I'm the worst. Don't think this kind of self-hatred, self-pity mind that says I'm the worst is not pride. It's a form of pride in Buddhism. You're clinging to something. You're clinging to me. That's the worst. Forget it. I mean, there's no worse. There's no better. Like that. So all the delusions arise from that. And then on the basis of grasping an I, thinking there is some inherently existent I, which we have to talk more about later, but on the basis of that, then we cherish this I and think it's the most important one. So I am the centre of the universe. Everybody else is there to serve me. It's called self-cherishing. It is so instinctive within us that it's hard to see it. And when you start to see it, it almost makes you want to vomit. It's so pervasive. You remember the angry young man story? The angry young man, almost, he's scared to see beyond what it would be like not to be an angry young man. And it's like that with us, with self-cherishing. It's almost scary and unimaginable to think what it would be like if we didn't cherish ourselves most. It's so pervasive, it's hard to see that there's a difference. That's why we need these enlightened beings around showing us that the opposite actually makes you happy, that the opposite actually makes everybody else happy. It's amazing. So self-cherishing, the antidote to that is compassion, cherishing others. The opposite to ignorance, not knowing, marikpa, the main ignorance being ego grasping, thinking there really is an I. Well, sure I'm going to die, and sure I change from moment to moment, but there really is some solid kind of thing here. The opposite to that is wisdom, rigpa. So, method and wisdom, compassion, the two elements that will help us to break down, dismantle, dismantle this whole apparatus of samsara that's keeping us trapped, and make us free. And Hung is what? Hung is invoking the blessings of the Buddha into our hearts. So basically you are praying to all the universal loving kindness, compassion, energy, wisdom in the universe, however you perceive it to be, whether you perceive it to have a label Chinrezig, whether you perceive it to have a label God or Jesus or you know, divine being or higher self or whatever. You're opening up and you're praying to that. And you are asking, you know, may all the wisdom and compassion of every single enlightened being enter into my heart, stabilize, and become firm so that my ordinary body, speech and mind can transform into the enlightened body, speech and mind. That's the meaning of the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum. It contains the whole path. And it's said that by reciting this mantra helps to soften the heart and to open the heart and to develop more compassion to others, more kindness. So I said yesterday I gave homework, and the homework was, if you let go of everything completely, there are no difficulties. Now, that is amazing homework, because you might have recited that non-stop for 24 hours. You still would need to recite it for years more, because you see, because it just becomes more and more the subtleties of letting go reveal themselves more and more. And you realize you can't just let go like that. You have to let go by having wisdom. When you have wisdom, things fall away by themselves, in and of themselves. When you don't have wisdom, you just can't see how to do it, you see. So all these teachings the Buddha gave, and the Geshe study for 24 years, I mean, we can study lifetimes, but what they do is they develop within your heart, within the very intrinsic essence of your being, an immovable, without doubt, you know, what can I say? Immovable, undoubtable, what can I say? Like firm, stable wisdom, knowing, that is so strong that all your wrong concepts just fall away. And there isn't even the thought to let go, because you couldn't see any reason to hold on. There will be no reason to hold on, because there's nothing to hold on to. So this is why there's so many teachings in Buddhism, and why we have all these different meditations and techniques. We keep hitting inside at that wrong, that kind of hard, solid wrong way of viewing things, and gradually changing our view, getting glimpses, and gradually shifting. And it takes time. It's kind of like you've been driving a car full speed along the wrong lane of the highway for a long time, and you can't just, you know, spin the driving wheel around, you'll have an accident. I mean, you just can't do it. I mean, you have to gradually get into the slow lane, and then, you know, incrementally turn a little bit, and get off, and then get back on the right track. It takes time. It takes time to change the mind. But with wisdom, it comes effortlessly, you see. It's not pushing, it's not repressing, it's not suppressing, it's just the letting go happens. So that's why we focus on just changing our way of seeing things and becoming more realistic. We let go of the outside appearance, we let go of the superficiality of life and the grossness and the distractions and that, and we develop more awareness. And the actual meaning of meditation, Tibetan, is gone, and the meaning is familiarity, and it just means we start becoming familiar with positive habits, positive ways of doing things. So Rinpoche, in the very first chapter, I'm not going to get beyond the first chapter, I tell you. No, don't think. I'm on the second page now, I think. Okay, fourth page. Rinpoche says, meditation is using... Oh, here he is. Oh, I'm going to start up here. He says, the root of our problems is within our mind. It's our unskillful ways of thinking. We have to recognize the right ways of thinking which bring happiness, and the wrong ways of thinking which bring suffering. With one way of thinking, we have problems in our life. With another way of thinking, we don't. In other words, happiness and suffering comes from our own mind, and mind creates our life. Then he says, meditation is using our own mind, our own positive attitudes, to heal ourselves. And we shouldn't restrict our definition of healing to recovery from one particular disease, but expand it to include the healing of all problems and their causes. Meditation is simply a label for what we do with our mind, and it's the best treatment because it has no side effects. So I think the best ingredients for this course, you know, when Terry asked me to teach a course, I thought, how am I going to give 6 talks? And then when I start talking, I think, how am I going to cover everything in 6 talks? But that was okay, because you just do what you do, so that's fine. And I would, you know, like to leave my meditations, but I'm actually, you know, very appreciative, and I know Van Dundrup is doing, contributing so much to the centre, so much to all the people who come here, and people tell me how beautiful meditations are, so I'm very happy with that. So I just do what I do, and from my side, I think if you cultivate this attitude, it's like relaxed, open, and kind. Try to have this. And when we have a mind, because we're dealing with a mind, you see, we're trying to change the mind. If I give a talk, then I will just talk these different things, and you just let them drift in. And then, because we're dealing with a mind, the best way to deal with a mind is not tight and this and that, but just relax, open, and kind. Relaxed, open, and kind. Rock. Oh, okay. Relaxed, open, and kind. And then just enjoy, and see how things go. So the subject this morning really has been the very important topic of kindness, and thinking about death, and thinking about the real meaning of life. What do we want to have accomplished? And as I say, when you think about death, it's not necessary that you change anything except for maybe the way you do things, as I mentioned yesterday, because what happens and it's how we deal with it. And how we deal with it, how we deal with everyone we meet, with everything we do, So that's the practice. All the prayers and the mantras and prostrations and circumambulations, they're just to help us to deal with things the best way.
Om Mani Padme
feel that my mother, she gave me so many things, but the most precious thing that she gave me was her death. I mean, first she gave birth to me, so she gave me life, but then just going through that experience of watching somebody you love so much and you're so close to die, it gives you your life back again. It shows you how precious this life is. So I'm sure you all have received that gift from others, either in the form of death or in the form of other things. It's very important to take that gift and use it. I think it's Helen Keller, she said, when one door closes, we often sit staring at the closed door for so long that we don't realize another door is opened right next to us. Which is the source of all happiness, the success, myself and all living beings, immediately be generated where it's not been generated, from my own mind and mind of others, and where it has been generated meant not decline but increase more and more. He's a very great scholar and also a great meditation, great yogi, great meditator. His name is Geshe Wunchen in Drupal Monastery. And he's my teacher many years ago when I was first ordained in London. At the time he was living in England and he learned English. He was a very, very good teacher. He was invited to go to a meditation center up in the north of England, in Cumbria. This big place. And they asked him to go and give a talk on the nature of mind. The nature of mind? Yeah. So they asked him to give a talk on the nature of mind. And So Geshe arrived, you know, and he brought tens of gongpas, very big meditation hall, maybe twice the size of this. It's full of people, and they're all looking forward to this talk. So then Geshe walked in, and he did his prostrations, and he sat down, and then he started to do his meditation. That's his motivation. And he sat there quietly, didn't say anything, and so. And so everybody sat and waited for Geshe to say something. And they waited. And they waited. And they waited. And 5 minutes went past. They didn't say anything. And they thought, well, he's probably just kind of setting his motivation, doing his prayers, you know, getting ready. So they sat and waited. And sometimes Geshe would look down, sometimes he'd look up and look around at everybody, sometimes he'd take his mala and, you know, just recite a few mantra. Didn't say anything. 10 minutes went past. They thought, well, you know, must just be taking a little bit longer than usual. They waited. Another 5 minutes went past. That's 15 minutes now. Everyone's just sitting, waiting, waiting, waiting. And they started to get very restless. And I just suddenly, you know, all around the room, there's all this moving and shifting. And just about to get up and walk out. And Geshe opened his eyes. And he looked around the room. And he said, sometimes it's very good just to sit and watch the mind. And I all realized what he'd been doing with them. And then he went and gave this beautiful teaching on the nature of the mind. I don't think we're going to use those maps on Buddha Pujas. I meant to tell you before, I'm not sure she's going to photocopy. I don't think we're going to use them. Yeah. Oh, just as long as nobody's putting effort. So this morning I started talking about all kinds of things, and it's like I opened quite a lot of sentences. And this actually is a little bit my style. You know when you go into the computer and you're doing like, and you open a lot of boxes? And you don't close them, you just kind of move to the next one, and the next one, the next one. So I've got quite a few open files at the moment. So I want to kind of just finish off the work and close them up. And so I've got quite a few open files still to deal with. That's okay, because just carrying things over. So I started saying quite a few things, and I didn't actually get to the end of the point of what I was saying. But before I do that, I thought maybe there might be some questions. today's discussion group or yesterday's discussion group or just in general anything, if anyone wanted to ask any questions. You had a list of questions, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's still relevant for people though.
Oh. Did anything come up today in the discussion group? No?
I was just wondering about hormonal patterns.
They used to translate it that way. Mind you, they used to translate Tibetan Buddhism, Islamism, so they really didn't know what they were talking about. They used to think any monk was a lama, any nun was a lama. So, all hail to the jewel in the lotus. I would say jewel lotus is okay, because money is jewel, and pema is lotus. But the all hail bit is a little bit like Hail Mary, isn't it? I think they just kind of bung that on. All hail to the jewel and the lotus. No, I wouldn't say that. I would say more the way I explained it is the way it's been explained in my teaching, Kevjasapamashe, that what you're doing is you are invoking the wisdom and compassion of all the Buddhas to enter into your heart and stabilize and abide there so that your body, speech and mind can transform into the enlightened body, speech and mind of a Buddha. So if that can be contained within all hell and jewel and lotus, okay, but I actually don't think you can translate it. I think you have to just say Om Mani Padme Hum. And I also don't really think it matters if you know the meaning or not. Yeah, they do say, like with these things, the main factor is your faith. And they tell stories about this. They tell stories about, there's a very nice story about a woman whose main practice was a goddess called Chandali or Tsundali. It's not very commonly practiced in Tibetan Buddhism now. It's quite Chinese Buddhism, they do this Chunda practice. Anyway, her main practice was this goddess Tsundali, and she recited many, many of these mantras. It's something like Om Chundi Chundi Swaha, something like that. But she got the attainment, you know, she started to achieve the siddhis of this practice. And it said that at a time of famine, she was able to cook stones and as bread, so she was able to feed people because of her siddhis and her attainments. And then one time, a monk came along and he was staying with this woman. And he heard her reciting this mantra. He said, "You know, you got it wrong. It's not like that at all." He said, "You got it wrong. So you got the syllable wrong." He said, "It's not Om Chala Chala Chandi. It's something else." And he corrected her, so she started reciting it the correct way, and she couldn't do anything. Something. There's quite a few messages in that story, aren't there? There's also another very sweet story. I'll tell you this one. It's really cute. It's about this guy. And he went to his guru, he went to this lama, he went to his guru to get a mantra. And he walked in, and his guru was busy doing something. And he was very kind of stressed out, because he was right in the middle of something. It was just the most inappropriate time to walk in the room. And he made his three prostrations, and he said, "Please, will you give me a mantra that I can use, you know, for curing and healing?" And the lama turned around and just didn't go away. "Just go away. Just go away." And he said, "Thank you so much." and he went off. And he recited that it was the word was Ismaraleya, they say in the text, Maraleya. So he kept on reciting, you know, "Go away, go away, just go away. Go away, go away, just go away." He kept on reciting it. And he recited it with such a pure, sincere heart that he got to the point where he could actually cure sicknesses. And people would come to him with, you know, this disease or this spirit harm, and they'd come and they'd say, "Can you help?" And he would recite, you know, a mala of "go away, go away, just go away," and blow on them, and they'd be cured. And it just so happened that one time, this lama who'd given him, who said this to him, developed this huge boil on his nose, and he couldn't get rid of it. And then the thing was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then someone said to him, "Look, don't worry, there is a healer in the next valley, And he seems to be having amazing success. This is a very simple guy, but he seems to be having amazing success at getting rid of all kinds of different diseases and spirit harms. Go and see him, he'll sort you out. So Lama went up, he went along, he went off, as he went on. He arrives at this cave, and there's this little guy. I can't believe it! And the little guy says, can I help you? He says, well, I got this ball on my nose. He says, okay, well, you know.